Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Wellens, and this episode's guest, Shelley Adina. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers. I'm Edward Willett, your host. I started this podcast because I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, and I've always enjoyed talking to other writers about how they work. And that's what this podcast is all about. I talk with the science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. This is an exciting week for me. Today is August the 3rd, as I get this episode ready to go out. And on August the 6th, 2019, in case you're listening to this, you know, two or three years down the future, on August 6th, my book World Shaper, book one in the World Shaper series, from which this podcast takes its title, will be out in mass market paperback from Daw Books. It came out in trade paperback last September. And then in September, on September 10th, to be precise, the trade paperback plus audiobook and ebook of Master of the World, book two in the World Shaper series, will be coming out. And I am doing a giveaway for a paperback copy of World Shaper and a autographed ARC, Advanced Reader's Copy, of Master of the World. If you are hearing this almost as soon as it comes out, because the deadline is coming up, but if you are hearing this before August 7th, which is when I'll do the draw, just send me an email with the Master of the World ARC in the subject line, and the email address is ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T, at gmail.com. So send me that email, I'll enter you in the draw, and maybe you will be the lucky winner of the first two books in the World Shapers series. And I'm writing book three right now. The premise of the books is that there is a labyrinth of shaped worlds, and that within these worlds, the people who have shaped them live. They have designed them to their liking. They all came from the first world originally, our world, but they're all in this labyrinth now. And my main character, Shauna Keyes, was driven out of her shaped world, which she didn't even know she'd shaped. She'd somehow forgotten it until Carl Yatzer came and told her. He also told her that there was this adversary who's trying to destroy the labyrinth and all the shaped worlds, is taking them over one by one, and that the adversary is now in her world. And she ends up having to flee her world. And that's the substance of the first book. In the second book, she's in another world, which is one inspired by Jules Verne, which is why the book is called Master of the World, after the Jules Verne title. That one, they have to deal with a completely different situation. And then the third book, which I'm writing now, will take place in a world that features vampires and werewolves. So I'm really having a lot of fun with that, and I hope readers will enjoy it too. Master of the World is getting great reviews, had a great Publisher's Weekly review, just had a great one from Booklist that basically said anybody who's interested in geek culture will enjoy this book, because there are a lot of geek culture references, Star Trek and Star Wars and all sorts of things, plus some musical theater stuff too, because that's another one of my interests. I also wanted to mention that this blog has been shortlisted for an Aurora Award. That's Canada's top science fiction award, similar to the Hugos. It's voted on by the fans for best fan-related work. Voting is open now. If you go to priauroraawards.ca, priauroraawards.ca, you can join, if you are a Canadian citizen or resident, you can join the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association for a mere $10 Canadian, and then you will be eligible to vote for the Auroras, and if you maintain your membership, to nominate for them next year. And you will also receive a great voters package with many of the nominated works, novels, and short stories, and so forth. So check that out if you're Canadian, and if you like this podcast, feel free to vote for it for best fan-related work. All right, I think that covers off everything I need to say off the top of the hour, so let's get on with this episode's guest, Shelley Adina. Shelley Adina is the author of 24 novels published by Harlequin, Warner, and Hachette, and more than a dozen more published by Moonshell Books, her own independent press. She writes the magnificent Devices steampunk series, which is what we'll be talking about primarily, and as Charlotte Henry, also writes the Rogues of St. Just series of classic Regency romance, and as Adina Senft writes the Winberg Township Amish series. It's an interesting mixture.
she pronounced everything correctly.
Oh, that's a miracle. She holds an MFA in writing popular fiction from Seton Hill University and is currently at work on a PhD in creative writing at Lancaster University in the UK. She won the Romance Writers of America Rita Award for Best Inspirational Novel in 2005 and was a finalist in 2006. And when she's not writing, Shelley is usually quilting, sewing historical costumes, or enjoying the garden with her flock of rescued chickens. And yes, chickens do come into the steampunk book we're going to talk about today. So welcome to the World Shapers.
Thank you. Thanks for having me over.
Now, I wanted to tell you how I ended up reaching out to you. My wife is an engineer, and one of her former classmates, who is also an engineer, Carol Bachelou, is a fan of the podcast, and she said, you know who you should get on there? There's this steampunk author that I really enjoy, and you should reach out to her. And so I did, and so here you are. So you were recommended to me by a woman engineer, which makes perfect sense.
It does, actually. You'd be surprised how many engineers are in my readership.
I wouldn't at all, having read the book. It doesn't surprise me at all. And I've hung out with a lot. I'm not an engineer myself, but I've written a history book about engineering in Saskatchewan and hung out with a lot of engineers because of my wife is former president of the Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists of Saskatchewan. So I have a lot of engineers in my circle of acquaintances.
And I'm married to one, so there you go.
There you go. We'll start by going back into the past, which is where you write. So, you know, that kind of makes sense. But we won't go quite that far back. We'll go back to when you first became interested in writing in general and in writing the kind of thing that you write in particular. So how did that all begin for you?
It began in third grade. As a matter of fact, we were given a writing assignment, and I wrote this little story about a ghost in a graveyard. And my teacher, Miss Gilstein, bless her heart, wrote across the top in red ink after giving me like 10 out of 10. She said, "Ooh, you have me scared," which is, you know, what a lovely teacher would write there. But the thing is, I had never realized before that what went down on paper could affect people's emotions. And yes, it wasn't real, but to my 8-year-old mind, it was very real. And I decided then and there that this is what I was going to do when I grew up, was be a writer.
See, that's interesting to me, because one thing I often ask writers on this podcast is if when they started writing, if they showed what they wrote to people to see how they reacted. And to you, that kind of, it all started with that. And I'll get authors who'll say, well, no, I never wanted to show it to anybody. But I always think it was precisely that. It was sharing it with my classmates a little older than five and finding out that I was writing stories that they enjoyed that actually kind of made me think, you know,
this could be a thing.
Yeah, I can tell stories that other people like. And clearly it happened for you very early.
And this is why neither of us has any fear of reviews.
I guess that's it. Yeah, my classmates were reviewers for sure. That's for sure. So after you were five, how did it progress from there?
Well, that was 8 years old. And then in our neighborhood, we never played house. That was for kids in the city. We played like adventure. And so we'd watch episodes of the Wild Wild West with James West and Artemis Gordon. And as you know, that was like steampunk back in the 60s.
So loved that show.
I know, me too. So I always had to be James West because I was the oldest, but I really wanted to be Artemis Gordon coming up with the cool tech. So that's kind of where it embedded itself in my mind, and time went on and I got educated and went through a couple of writing degrees, and finally I got the flash for book one of this steampunk series, and it just took off from there. All that sort of desire and interest in Victorian technology just came to the fore.
Now, you grew up on Canada's west coast. In Canada, but a long way from there.
You're in the cold part.
Yeah, that's for sure. But did you, when you went into university, did you go straight in with the idea of going into creative writing, or did you start somewhere else?
Well, I sort of had a circuitous way of getting there. My family was very blue collar, so my mom always wanted me to go to university, but I wanted to travel. So I moved to Alberta and saved up my money as much as I could, and I went to Europe. And multiple times, you know, the backpacking trip to Europe that you do in your 20s. And that kind of opened my mind a little more to other cultures, other languages. I love languages, and they come fairly easily. So you'll notice that there's a lot of German and French as you progress through the series, because it's a very multinational sort of series. And so once I had the traveling done, I went to school. I emigrated to the States, and I started college when I was, 30 or something. And I always said I was going to get a license plate that said BA by 2K, because I was on the, you know, one class a quarter plan. But I got it in 95, and then I went into a master's program after that, got two master's degrees in writing, and now I told my mom I was taking this education train to the end of the line, so we're getting a PhD now.
Well, your undergraduate degree was in literature.
Literature, yeah.
What did that entail?
Well, I had a creative writing minor, so my undergrad thesis was a novel that will never see the light of day, but it gave me the confidence that I could finish a book.
So that would be the very first one that you wrote to completion? First novel you wrote to completion?
No, the first novel I wrote to completion was when I was 13. Oh. A Nancy Drew ripoff. Very adventurous.
Did you write other longer things while you were still growing up? Other novel attempts, or?
Well, it took me 5 years to write the Nancy Drew ripoff, just because that's what you turn to when you're a really introverted kid and you grow up in a religious group that's closed and you don't have any friends that are outside the church, and yet you want a larger life than the one you have, so you make it on paper. That's what I did.
I think at that age, my very first short story was called Castor Glass Hypership Test Pilot, because I had hit the science fiction thing really early.
Holy cow.
But I also wrote, I was reading, there was a fellow named William Galt, I think his name was, and he wrote auto racing books in the 50s. And so I went through that was my ripoff. I tried to write auto racing books, never having driven a car or even been to an auto race, but I did my best. So.
Well, I know. And I was doing massive adventures, taking cruises and going to foreign countries, and my characters are 14.
My favorite bit of juvenilia was the one I wrote called Ship from the Unknown, in which this strange ship shows up in my seaside town, which of course I'd never lived in either, where my characters were, and they end up, then there's a whole hidden high-tech civilization in the middle of the Amazon jungle, which nobody knew about until they got there. And even now I think, you know, we had satellites then, you couldn't hide something like that. What was I thinking? But it was a lot of fun to write, so yeah, that was the main thing for me then.
Right, when you're young, that's the main thing. And it's exercising your brain and giving it those muscles that it's going to need later on.
I always like to ask the people, and there are a few authors who went the formal creative writing course. Now, they sometimes run into teachers who are not amenable to the kind of fiction that they want to write, especially if they're tending toward the fantastic or the science fiction. I noticed your master's was actually in writing popular fiction, which is different from some of the more literary focused master's programs. Did you ever run into that, any of your teachers, or were they all really good?
In high school, I got told flatly to knock off this space opera nonsense and stick to what I knew, which was not good advice. I just basically ignored it. And the PhD program I'm in right now is very literary. So that was, even though I'm multi-published and I came into that program as a, you know, sort of a professional, that's not holding any water. But the MFA in writing popular fiction at Seton Hill, I think there's only two popular fiction master's programs in the country, and they were the first ones, and they're just fantastic. I was a romance major, but you can be a mystery major or a science fiction or a fantasy or a horror major. It's great.
Oh, if I'd known that existed.
It's been around since 1999.
Yeah, well, I graduated from university in 79, so I guess I could have done it, but I was busy doing other things by then. Well, that's interesting. I'm actually mentoring an MFA student from the University of Saskatchewan right now, and he's writing a young adult fantasy novel, which they seem to have no problem with, which makes me feel good. They're not saying you can't write that kind of stuff. So you mentioned briefly how Lady of Devices and what the whole series is called, Magnificent Devices. Is that right?
Book 18 just came out a couple of weeks ago.
You mentioned sort of getting the initial flash for that, but maybe before we talk about it in more detail, give us a synopsis.
Okay. The Cliff Notes version is that a young lady is the daughter of a Viscount, and Daddy bets the estate on the combustion engine, which, as everyone knows, is a failure. And he commits suicide, and she is thrown out onto the street. Because it's kind of based on the that bubble that was in the 1700s where everyone, it was Holland tulip bulbs. Yeah. Everyone invested in this thing that turned out to not even exist. So that's kind of what I was thinking about. All the investors, there was a riot in London, and they came and trashed the townhouse in Belgravia, and my heroine had to run for her life. She winds up with a street gang of children and becomes the queen of the London underworld.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I finished it, as I said before we started, I finished it about 10 minutes before we started the interview. So it's very fresh in my mind, the first book. Not a terribly long book. How many? I read it in Kindle. So how long would it have been?
It's kind of an introductory book. It's about 55,000 words. All the other books range between 65 and 75. So that this was the one that I have for free. So it's a launch pad.
Yeah, that's how they get you, is that first one's free.
And then... It's true.
So maybe in more detail, how did that idea come to you? And then how did you go about developing it? Detailed outliner, or do you kind of make it up on the fly? How does it work for you?
Well, every book starts with what I call the flash. It's an image that I don't know what comes before or after, but I know that that's kind of like the inciting incident. So the flash for Lady of Devices was a girl in a steam landau outside an underground station in London, and she's attacked by this gang of children and is lying in the street. And I'm like, whoa, who is this girl? Where's her family? What is she even doing in Whitechapel at this time of night? And the story just kind of iterates and builds as you try and go backwards and forwards from the flash. So I'm an outliner, but I'm not like the spreadsheet kind of outliner. I really, really like Blake Snyder's Save the Cat 15-point beat sheet. So that's kind of how I have been structuring the books. But now lately, I've been doing something that my mastermind group and I call the placemat plot. So we get large paper placemats from restaurants, and you can lay out your story in sections. You can draw like setting diagrams, mountains and rivers, and how am I going to manage this battle? And it's all in one spot, and you can fold it up and put it in your purse. So that's how I do things now with the placemat.
What is your mastermind group?
My mastermind group is a group of friends. We've been friends for 20 years, probably since before we were all published. And we get together a couple of times a year to retreat, to brainstorm plots together, to, we run covers past each other, back cover blurbs, how does this sound? Well, I'd fix it, and it would make it more exciting if you did this, this, and this. And all of us have our strengths. I'm really visual, so I like helping people with covers, and others of the group are really good at back cover blurbs, so they're always making mine better. And it's just a real wonderful give and take between professionals.
No, that does sound terrific. And something else I would have asked you if you hadn't mentioned it was if you had a group of either beta readers or, you know, anyone to that you bounce things off of, and it sounds like you do. And again, get all over the map with authors. Some, like me, first person who sees it is my editor, and that's kind of it. So.
Well, I don't have one of those except myself these days. But, you know, I was always a complete failure at critique groups. I produce much more quickly than they can read. And so having a meeting once a month was just the maximum in frustration and unhappiness for me. So I haven't had a critique group probably in 30 years, but I really enjoy the mastermind group because we're all sort of at the same level. Some of us are higher on the ladder. Some of us are a bit behind because of time, but we really mesh well together and are really helpful. I don't know what I'd do without them.
And I often think that that's what's important in those kinds of groups is that people are either at the same level or there are some that are a little bit above. But if you have people at wildly different levels, or you may find yourself not getting very useful advice because some people are just inexperienced and don't really know how to
exactly. Get good advice. And you're not really in the group to be a mentor. You're in the group to be like a sharing partner. So it there's a big difference in that kind of disparity.
I just wanted to back up for a minute because I was looking at your information here and I noticed that you actually taught or are still teaching, I guess, some.
Yeah, well, I taught at Seton Hill for 19 years from 2002 to just this past winter in 2019. And then, you know, with the PhD, I have to step away from it because I can't do it all at once plus release 4 books a year.
Yeah, it's tough when you're the only person.
Yeah, I know.
Teaching, you know, there's the what is it? It's from the King and I. Actually, there's a line by your if you teach by your students, you are taught, or something like that. Is one of the lines that's in there. Did you find that teaching others has helped you with your own writing?
I do, because having to take your process apart and reconstruct it on a PowerPoint deck is really, really hard. So I found my, you know, how do I do this? How do I build a world? How do I build a series? In fact, I'm giving a talk next weekend on planning and plotting your series. But I had to figure out what my own process was in doing that so that I could transmit it to students. And that has actually been really good for me because I have a very literal brain and it makes it happy to not have the woo-woo stuff, but just have it kind of laid out that this is how I do it. It's comforting somehow. But, you know, some people hate that. It's like, don't touch the magic or it will all shatter and I'll never be able to write another word.
Yeah. And again, one of the great things about doing this podcast is the wildly different ways that people approach all these things. This flash that you speak of that gives you the image. Mm-hmm. Is that true for all of your books? I mean, you write in other genres. You write romance, and do you get the same kind of start to those stories as for your steampunk stuff?
Yeah, it's just pretty much how my brain works. There's some kind of inciting reason for the story to be there, and that's usually what the flash is. Like, for instance, there's a book I wrote called Grounds to Believe, and I got a flash of a guy on a motorcycle trying to find his kid in a religious cult. And that was the start of a 4-book series.
Well, and you mentioned that you're going to give a talk on writing a series, and I did want to explore that too. So you've talked about how you build out from that initial flash for the book, but then you've got a whole series. So how did you develop it into a series from that initial thing?
Well, Lady of Devices was only supposed to be like one or two books, and I'm on number 18 now. But so there's a lot of things that brain does in the background that you're not really aware of. It's cooking the soup while you're putting in ingredients on the front end. So one book grew to a 4-book sort of little mini series, and then two more books came after that, and two more books came after that, and then four books after that. And they're all like in segments, but they're all connected. It's one huge story. I had the big bad in book one, but I didn't know who that person was until book seven. So I tell my writing students, trust the brain because it knows what it's doing. And I see in J.K. Rowling's books, like the Harry Potter series, stuff she seeded in book one, she, you know, knowing her, she's a genius. She probably put them there intentionally, but my brain does that without me knowing about it. So I can be like six books along and go, oh, that's what that's for. And then write and develop it.
Well, that brings up another thing. I've been on panels at conventions talking about writing series. The longest thing I've written was a five-book young adult series called Shards of Excalibur. And but even in that, and I wrote a trilogy, which I guess technically probably had more words, as many words in it as the five-book young adult series. Do you ever find that something that you did not intentionally seed, you've said something you didn't intentionally seed can develop later into something you use, but is there ever something that you put in on the spur of the moment that then later on causes you a problem and you think, oh, drat, I'd really like to do that, but I closed that door back in book three or whatever?
Yeah, that happens sometimes. In the mystery, the Mysterious Devices spinoff series, I think I'm so smart and I'm planting red herrings up front. And what they turn into is loose threads just waving in the wind. So I have to go back and remove them because what I thought was such a good idea at the time turns out not to be. And then those odd little accidental things like a brooch showing up on somebody's dress collar turns into a major deal. So who knew? I trust the brain. I just let it do its thing.
Well, and for me, at least, it's even when you make those kind of problems for yourself, that's actually part of the fun of writing is then finding out a way to solve those problems or work around them or make them work for you.
Or just delete the wretched things. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that could work too, but not if it's already published. That's
yeah, that's kind of a problem.
Do you ever run into continuity issues where, you know, the bulk of stuff piles up the longer the series goes on? And do you find yourself having to constantly refer back to what you've written to make sure that you don't contradict yourself?
I do, actually. My mom has been creating a series Bible for me. I think she's up to like book seven now. So that's been really helpful in keeping everything straight. And I also have a continuity reader who lives in Ontario who is an English expat. And so he has been incredibly helpful with, you know, you said this in book three, but now you're saying this in book six. Did you mean to do that? And I'm like, I forgot. So between the two of them, they're keeping me on the straight and narrow, keeping the steam train on the track.
Well, I've just started the new series that this podcast takes its name from. It's called World Shapers, and I don't know how long it will run. It's with my DAW books in New York. Mm-hmm. But book two is coming out this fall, mm-hmm. and I'm already wishing I had a continuity.
Yes. Well, technically, your editor is going to be keeping track of that.
She is. She catches stuff. But even so, going through the page proofs every once in a while, I'll find things, you know.
And take it from me. Create your series Bible now.
Yeah, that's what I should do. Master of the World is the name of the next one. It's actually steampunk. So this is another reason this is interesting to talk to you right now.
Oh, cool.
It's set in a Jules Verne-inspired world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So going back to the actual writing, what does your writing process look like? Do you, sit in a garret and write longhand by candlelight, or do you have a home office, or do you go out to coffee shops? What's your process?
Well, when the power goes out, Sweetie hooks up the generator and gets everything booted back up so that I can work. No candles for me. So I'm actually very disciplined because I used to be an executive assistant arranging executives' time for a living. So organizing my own time is a piece of cake in comparison. So I work from 9 till noon on left brain stuff. So the accounting, the blankety blank Facebook ads manager, things like that. Creating ad creative, all that stuff that you have to do for promo. So that's in the morning, 9 to noon. Noon to one, I'm outside with the chickens just to let my brain expand again back to its normal shape. From 1 to 4 is my writing hours. And 1,000 words a day is my daily output 7 days a week. If it takes me 45 minutes, great. If it takes me all those agonizing hours, then great too, but it has to go on the page. So that's the shape of my day. People say, oh, how are you so productive? And I look at them and I say, discipline. Then again, I don't have kids, so I can be disciplined.
Yeah, discipline is something I'm aware of. People tell me I'm productive too, but in my back of my mind is always, I could be so much more productive if I were more disciplined. So,
when you're kind of floating the boat and this is what's paying for, you know, the power bill, you get pretty disciplined in a hurry.
Oh, well, I've been doing this full time for 25 years, so I guess I'm managing, but I'm a bit scattered on the things that I work on from day to day. This depends on what kind of deadlines I have and on what kind of projects, because I write all sorts of stuff. So,
well, that's the thing. The deadlines pretty much dictate what you're going to do from day to day. It's triage. You just have to do it.
Exactly. So once you have a first draft, which, let's see, 7,000 words a week, and let's say it's a 70,000 words, that's 10 weeks.
Yep, or more. I allow myself 3 months per book. And so the final month is the beta readers, editing, layout, that kind of stuff.
And that was my next question. Once you have a first draft, if it works for you that way, do you edit, do you sort of do a rolling draft where it's done when you get to the end? Do you then start back at the beginning and do a whole revision? How does that work?
I do a rolling draft at the beginning of each day's work. I read the previous day's work and do an edit, and that just kind of launches me into the current day's work. Then once the book is finished and I type those two beautiful words, then I go back and I do it's kind of like the flesh and makeup draft. You know, you put in, if this scene is missing a certain emotional beat, that goes in. If the description of some device or a landscape is missing, that goes in. Just kind of fleshing it out and making it more real. That sensation of dropping into a story and being able to see it and experience it, I'm really focused on that for my readers, so they get what they pay for.
That's kind of what I focus on in my rewrite. Like, it's pretty good. I would say it's about 80% done when I get to the end. And then that pass through the next time is all about beefing up the language and specific details and things like that. Now, you say you don't have a critique group, but you do have beta readers.
Yeah.
How many of those do you have, and what do they do for you?
I have my English gentleman in Ontario, my lifesaver. I have one of the people in the mastermind group likes to beta read my mysteries in particular, because she's writing cozy mysteries. Nancy Warren, she's doing the Vampire Knitting Club cozy mystery series. So she's been extremely helpful in, oops, that red herring is now a waving piece of yarn in the wind. You need to tie that one up. Victoria Thompson, the mystery writer, was very helpful. She's on the faculty at Seton Hill. And as we would drive to school from the airport, I would get private master classes in how to do a mystery really well from her. So she's been wonderful.
And then once you have the comments from them, do you do another pass through?
Yes, I layer in everything they've said, which sometimes has the ripple effect, and things down the line then change because of what they suggested. So I have to catch the ripples and fix them. And then the book is done and it goes into layout and up for pre-order.
Because you're your own editor.
I am. I can't afford me. I mean, I couldn't afford someone like me.
But you have in the past written for traditional publishers.
Yes.
How was that change from having an editor to being your own editor?
Well, to be honest, for the Regency and the Amish books, I send them to my old editor, and she does what she used to do when we were both at Hachette. Leslie Peterson was my editor at Hachette, and we had a great working relationship. And so for those two genres, I send them to her for a developmental edit, which adds, you know, a couple of weeks into the production schedule, but I think it's been worth it.
And what does she do? Do you get a lot of line-by-line edits, or what exactly is she looking for?
She's, well, the thing about being the project manager for these is that I know what it needs. So I say I need, like, an emotional edit for the romances in particular, because I've been doing adventure for, what, almost 10 years or something. And sometimes you want the emotional stuff in there, but you forget because you're so busy, you're so caught up in the adventure. So that's why I have to go back and make sure the emotional beats are there. But particularly in a romance, this is vital. And sometimes I'm too close to it, and I ask for an emotional developmental edit, and Leslie delivers. She knows what it needs, and so she'll write in, you know, the motivation to back up this declaration of love is not here. Here's where you could work it into these scenes, and you need to add a scene in chapter 3 that brings this out. And so she's very, very detailed and very good at helping me get that right, because I don't want to disappoint the readers in that department either.
So it sounds like you would say that there is definitely a value to editors for writers.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. The good ones are worth their weight in gold.
You are happy with yourself as an editor?
I'm a copy editor. I'm not a developmental editor. For the steampunk, I'm so deep in the world that I kind of know where it's going. I know the characters so well that I can bring out their emotions and bring out the world without the developmental edit. But for the romance in particular, I feel like I need a dev editor, and the Amish certainly, because that's a whole other level of complication. But for copy editing, I'm pretty confident. And I think my beta reader, she found 2 errors in the last manuscript, so I was feeling pretty happy about that.
I did want to ask you about the Amish romance, because that's an unusual genre, not one that I have encountered talking to science fiction and fantasy authors very often. However, what was it, 2 years ago? Yeah, or I guess it was the sesquicentennial, so yeah, it would have been 2 years ago. I was at a thing at our local chapters with several other local authors, you know, Canadian authors in the house kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they had us scattered around the store. And for some reason, I was seated up where I was looking at this rack of romance novels. And I was looking at them, and I was seeing, maybe it was one of yours, I was seeing Amish romance and other subgenres that I had no idea that they existed. So how did you end up writing in that particular subgenre?
Well, there is a parallel universe out there called the Christian Booksellers Association, and Amish is the biggest seller in that book. It's like the ABA, only for the Christian publishing side. Mm-hmm. Amish is pretty much the Tyrannosaurus Rex that ate the rest of the industry. People in that readership love them. And so my editor at Hachette gave me the BDI one time when we met at a conference to have lunch. And she says, "Why aren't you writing Amish romance? You grew up plain. What's wrong with you?" And I said, "Well, you know, I left that in my 30s. I kind of am okay with leaving that behind." And she looked at me and she said, "Hachette needs an Amish author." And she offered me 6 figures. And I said, "Okay, we're in."
Well, I guess I vaguely knew it existed, but I suppose if it's not what you read, then there's all sorts of these subgenres out there that you may not be familiar with. So it was interesting to me.
Well, and the learning curve was not as high as it could have been, because I grew up in a plain church. So the doctrines and things were very much the same, but the customs, the clothing, the world building, the lack of electricity and all that stuff that means was like a 90-degree learning curve. So I've been out to Pennsylvania many times. Luckily, Seton Hill is in that state, so it was pretty easy. I go out there twice a year and I do a little research trip on the side.
Do you think it's kind of that low-tech lifestyle that actually makes it appealing to people?
Yeah, the getting off the fast lane and taking a country road behind a horse and buggy. I actually drove a horse and buggy, nearly ran into a bus.
I've trundled along behind a horse and buggy. And
Yeah, it was quite the experience. But you know, how are you supposed to know how your characters feel and behave with the reins in their hands? Who knew that the reins came through the windshield in two little slots? I mean, stuff like that that Amish readers just eat up because they love the detail. And so you, for me, feet on the ground research in the Amish genre is necessary.
Well, this podcast is called The World Shapers, and you know, it does that whole idea of how we shape our fictional worlds. It sounds like also from, you know, you've been in Belgravia and London, and you've been in Lancaster County and yep. talking with Amish women, and
yep.
Research is something else I always ask about. So what kind of research do you do for any of your books? I mean, in the case of the steampunk books, there's also some technical things in there. And I don't know how much work do you put into making these devices mm-hmm. practical, or if they could really exist. You said you're married to an engineer. So does he help with that?
He has been very helpful, as a matter of fact. I had to blow up a dam once. And so we're like, you know, Arlo Guthrie with the 8x10 glossies and the X's and the circles and the arrows.
And you just hope that it doesn't fall into the wrong hands.
Well, exactly. People wonder about my Google search history.
Yeah, that's true of all of us. So do you do a lot of research?
I do a lot of research, yeah. And some of it is just serendipitous. Like I was at a bed and breakfast one morning and I was moaning and groaning to the innkeeper about how I needed to know whether there could be a steam-powered submarine. And he turned around and he said, "Why don't you ask him? He's a submarine captain." So, you know, book 7 took shape right then and there because I had undersea dirigibles and they're technically correct in how they operate. But, you know, some things like the behemoth in books 9 through 12, I sort of take it for granted that the reader's imagination will lead them into the guts of that machine where I am afraid to go.
So, the other thing, you are publishing most of this now. Well, I guess all of the steampunk books are published yourself.
Yeah.
And having started my own similar company last year, Shadowclaw Press, I'm always interested in that. What I have found in my dabbling with it is there's a lot more work goes into putting out your own books than you might think before you launch into it. So how do you balance that with also getting the writing done?
Well, that's running the business is part of the stuff that happens in the morning with my left brain. Because I do publish one or two other people's books, and I'm actually kind of not doing the best job. They're very forgiving people. But because these days with the whole pay-to-play advertising thing, you can get lost in a rabbit hole of advertising and never come out. And it kind of affects your emotions too. So the emotions affect how you're writing the books. And yeah, if you spend too much time in that rabbit hole, you're not going to be able to put the words down on the paper. So it's a fine balance. I use time to make sure that the balance happens, like 9 to noon. That's all you get. You can't have any more of my life than 9 to noon. And then I'm free. The brain shuts off and then I'm free to go into my imaginary worlds in the afternoon.
Do you, you're your own copy editor, but do you then farm out cover design and layout?
Yes. Well, no, I do my own layout because vellum is like the best thing that was ever invented.
I was going to say, I got the free ebook and I started it up and I said, oh, she's using vellum.
Yes.
Because I use it too, and I instantly recognized that little swirly symbol.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
They do fabulous job. It does a fabulous job. It's only available for Mac, I think, if anybody's curious about it. But if you're a Mac user and you do your own books, you should definitely check out Vellum.
Yeah, it's like a creative act in itself. And I like making beautiful things like costumes and quilts and books that look pretty.
I've done 3 so far with my press, and they're all... they've all been done on vellum, and I haven't had any complaints about it at all.
Yeah. And I do copy edit for other authors, so that those morning hours is sacred also. If I have a client on deck, then that they get those morning hours when I'm fresh.
Clearly, I need to adopt your schedule because I do all of this stuff too, only not in as organized a fashion.
Well, remember the executive time in 15-minute blocks? That's kind of this is what it derives from.
So, and then you mentioned that you do farm out your cover art. Do you give a lot of input into what you want, or do you leave quite a bit of that up to the artists?
Well, I figure I'm hiring a pro who's good at what they do, and I would say something like, I need a Victorian woman on the cover, like for my Mysterious Devices series. Each mystery has a watercolor color in it from the 1800s palette. So the one that came out last week or the week before, the matchmaker wore Mars yellow. I'll send Jenny at Seedlings, she's my cover designer for these books, I'll send her Mars yellow from the 1800s palette and say, you know, find me a Victorian woman, here's the dress color, and I need a watercolor background. And she creates it. And we've worked together for so long now that it's like one and done. She's really good.
Well, it's nice, I guess, to have the same artist for every cover in a series.
Yes, and actually, I think that's really important because there is that continuity. Once the reader's eye is trained to look for your covers, if suddenly in the middle of the series you go with something different, then you lose them, like literally on the results page.
How quickly do you then get things published once all this is done? One of the nice things about the self-publishing is, of course, that it's like once it's ready to go, it goes.
Right, so exactly.
You're putting out 4 books a year, I think you said?
Yes, the last Wednesday of every quarter in the middle month of the quarter is release day. And so I have everything is kind of backed up from there. So Jenny is now booking out about 6 months. So I have booked my February cover already, and she'll be starting work on it in September.
And what has the response been from readers?
They really like these watercolor covers, and they're selling quite briskly. Thank you, readers.
Yes, but what has the response of the readers been to your books is what I was actually asking.
Oh, to the Mysterious Devices?
Yes.
Well, the steampunk readers were willing to give me a chance. They were willing to follow these new characters into the same world. They like being in that world, and they like coming back to it. One reader wrote on, I think it was on Amazon, that it's like coming home again, and they can just sink into the world and be in a familiar place that they love. And these new characters, they're willing to go along with them. Some people don't like the new sleuths, but, you know, that to each their own. So I think building the world and having people that your readers can relate to is really important when you're doing a long-running series, because they want to come back to it. And so the response has been pretty healthy, I think. The pre-orders have been nice to see.
I guess one thing that I have run across is that they're usually following a series that they like. They're not necessarily following an author that they like. Do you think that's fair, that it's the series that draws them in, and will they follow you to something else if you've completely changed? Do you have overlap, I guess, between your Amish romance readers and your steampunk readers, or is it one or the other? They are sort of separate groups.
They're separate groups. There were some of the steampunk readers that told me flat out, I can't read romance. I'm here for the adventure. And there's others that said, well, you know, it's you. I trust you. I'm going to take a leap. I've never read a romance before, but because you're writing it, I'll try. And that reader was happy because she got the world building. She got the characters, the sympathetic characters that she liked in this new genre that she had never been exposed to before. So I called that a win.
You're broadening horizons.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that kind of leads into my big philosophical questions here towards the end of the conversation. And I always ask, first of all, why do you write? Second, why do you think any of us write? And third, why do we write fantastical stories of stuff that never really existed?
Oh boy, hard questions. Why do we write? I write to shut up the voices in my head.
I hear that a lot.
My mom says, how do you know a book is done? And it's like, they stop talking. So that's pretty much, I mean, I'm hearing bits of description in my head all the time. I'm hearing people talking. I see the flash. It's like you have to, and the only thing that cures that noise is writing it down. So part of it's therapy. Part of it is it comes out of you. You can't help it. I suppose it's like a composer. We went and saw Rocket Man on Tuesday, and the way they showed the music playing in Elton John's head all the time as a kid, that's kind of how I feel now with writing, that the stuff is, words are happening all the time. And what was the second question?
Why do you think people write in general? Why do any of us write? Why do we tell stories?
Because that's a basic human need. Right from in the cave around the campfire, you told the story of the poisonous plant or the small creature with the nasty bite to be kind of a cautionary tale for your companions. And so it's transmuted, I think, into here's situations maybe that you will never live, but if you did, here's what you could do. I used to love the series of books called The Worst Case Scenario Handbook, because it's like, okay, I do know how to jump from a moving train if I ever need to. So, you know, I could steer an undersea dirigible if I never needed to. I think that, and we want to be heard. We, you know, sitting in our rooms, we want to say something that someone will want to go, oh, I want to come and live in your world with you. Let's be friends. I think that's why I do it.
And then why do you think we write stories of the fantastic? I mean, there will never be a world in which a steam took over and the internal combustion engine failed. So.
Well, you never know. After the apocalypse, anything could happen.
Well, that's true. What's the appeal to the fantastic and the made up and the imaginary?
Well, for me, it's that limitless horizon that I could, my imagination is free to play in this space, and by golly, it's going to, and I'm going to write it down and have fun and then say, hey, come on, look at this thing. Isn't it cool? And somebody else will say, yeah, that's cool. Let's tell somebody else. And so not only do I have a world I'm living in that's fantastic, and you know, there's giant behemoths, and Venice is built on a huge clockwork, and it changes every time the church bells ring. You can have that, and you can live there and have adventures that you couldn't in real life. I think it's kind of like space exploration from your armchair.
Well, that occurs to me that I failed to ask you something off the top, which is most of us, when we become writers, it's because of the books that we read. So what were the books that drew you into telling these kinds of stories back when you were reading as a kid?
Oh boy. I read the classics like Little Women and Anne of Green Gables. I have the entire library of Lucy Maud Montgomery in first editions. Mm. I'm that big of a fan. Yeah, if the house ever burns down, those are coming with me. I read that. I read a lot of English authors like Elizabeth Googe, not the one that wrote that story about Savannah. That was Eileen Googe. I don't know if they're related, but anyway, this kind of turn of the century children's authors I really liked, and I didn't really get into fantasy and science fiction as much until I was grown up and I could kind of, I don't know, handle it maybe. And then steampunk just seemed to be, the characters seemed to be an outgrowth of those English characters that I knew and loved as a child. And that there's that element of the Saturday afternoon serial in the theater also that I really liked, those adventures in the theater as a kid.
Steampunk is very much where those two things come together, isn't it? The kind of Victorian era story, the Dickens and all that, and then the super science story, they all kind of meet right there in Jules Verne's time.
Yeah, and you can make it up, and if as long as you make it believable, it doesn't have to be, you know, physically correct. I don't have to build models or anything, but my aim is this believable? And so far, I think it's working because I check it with my engineer husband.
A useful thing to have. As I said, I have an engineer wife. So
I know. They're very handy.
They are. Well, in my case, not least because I often say that my, she kind of hates this joke, but my best move as a freelance writer was to marry an engineer. That's kind of
I agree with you.
So what are you working on right now? Although at the pace at which you're working, it might be what are you working on next will be what you're working on when this comes out.
No, well, I alternate the Regency romances with the steampunk mysteries. So I have just plunged in. I'm three chapters into The Rogue Not Taken, the follow-up to The Rogue to Ruin, my Rogues of St. Just Regency romances. So we're on the middle book now.
And looking ahead?
Looking ahead, I will be in, let me see, I'm looking at my schedule here. So that would come out in August. My November book would be what I call the manor house novellas that are kind of in the Magnificent Devices world and follow some of the characters. So the next one in that little series is called Gwyn Place. We're going to go to Lady Claire's home. In February, the next Mysterious Devices book comes out, and then after that, the next Regency. So yeah, I'm eyeballing my calendar because it's all laid out. I have to have it. I have to have dates to work towards. I'm very date driven.
And for your readers, where can people find you online?
I am at shellyadina.com. That's Shelley with an E-Y, like the poet. And I have an ongoing blog. I'm doing a Blogging the PhD series, which may or may not be interesting to anyone but me. Also, things about the books. I'm going to be talking, Mysterious Devices 3, The Matchmaker Wore Mars Yellow, is very, it's the Wild West. So there's a lot of old pistols and armaments and things in that book. And so I'm going to be doing one or two blog entries about the inspirations for those guns, which again may or may not be very interesting to a whole lot of people, but it's interesting to me.
And you're also on other social media, are you?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at Shelley Adina. I'm on Pinterest. You can see all kinds of inspirations for the things that I put in books, and some of it are just made up out of my head, but some of them, you know, there's amazing steampunk artists out there, and I'm like, wow, I could take the leg off of this creature and really do something with it. And let me see, what else am I on? I'm a failure at Instagram, so don't look for me there. And I'm on Facebook as Shelley Adina.
I did realize there's one last thing I forgot to ask you about. Mm-hmm. Why do you like chickens?
Because the engineer that I live with has allergies to pet dander, and this chicken walked into our yard one day and said, hey, I'm going to stay. So we built her a coop and got her some companions, and I've been doing rescue for 20 years now.
Because the affinity for chickens is one of the things that Claire shows.
Shares with me. Yep, exactly. In fact, I have Dinah, the office chicken, is overseeing this conversation at this very moment.
Well, and doing a very good job, I'm sure.
She knows when to be quiet.
Well, thanks so much for being a guest on The World Shaper, Shelley. It's been a great chat.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're most welcome. So thanks again to Shelley Adina for being on The World Shapers. I really enjoyed that talk. I hope you did too. I hope you'll come back for future World Shapers episodes. Coming up next after Shelley will be Fonda Lee. After Fonda, Cameron Hurley. And after Cameron, John Kessel. And then Susan J. Forrest. That's the next four lined up. And I'm working right now on getting some more great guests going forward. You can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers, and you can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers, or search for The World Shapers podcast. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett, W-I-L-L-E-T-T, edwardwillett.com. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, again, two T's on Willett, and you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. And again, two T's on Willett. Funny how that happens, but That second T gets dropped off so often that even in my very first page proofs for my first book from Daw Books, Lost in Translation, I had to correct that on the title page, the two T's on Willett. They know how to spell my name now, but that first book, I had to correct that. So it's a problem I've dealt with my whole life. But as problems go, it's a pretty minor one. Thanks again for listening to The World Shapers. I hope you will come back many more times in the future and also check out all the great interviews that have already taken place. You can find a complete archive of episodes at theworldshapers.com. On the main page, you'll see a link to archive. Click on that and enjoy. And I guess that's it for this week. I will talk to you again soon. Bye for now.